Don, old buddy, do you want to read these to the voice goes out or summarize them? Probably all get over it, but I think it'll help us lead in what we're doing.
Okay.
Here comes Bob Chandler's part, man.
That's better than anything.
First of all, we went over the minutes of August 9 meeting and those were approved. And September 23rd minutes relating to arson related offenses. I went over the minutes and we discussed the meeting with respect to that and arson round. And I explained what would take place in that with respect to Mr. Chandler, Mr. Spaulding, who would be present. And the change we've made in the arson draft had been made with an attempt to conform the recommendations to the guidelines expressed by members of the office. And with respect to forgery and delayed offenses, preliminary draft number one. Okay, now page two, section one. Chandler asked if the definitions of complete written instrument and incomplete written instrument were intended to differentiate between degrees of the crime of forgery. He was told by Ms. Paulette that the difference in degree would be determined by the nature of the instrument forged and not by the manner in which the forgery was committed. And that's an important consideration that we want to keep in mind on forgery, that whether it's a complete written instrument or incomplete would have no effect on the degree of the crime. Then Ms. Chandler asked, would it be possible to draw a single definition broad enough to encompass the first three subsections of section one? We discussed that at some length. And then I pointed out commentary from the New York Code and indicating forgery could be committed by anyone with the five following separate acts. Falsely making a complete written instrument, falsely making an incomplete written instrument, falsely completing an incomplete written instrument, falsely altering an incomplete written instrument, or by falsely altering a complete written instrument. And discuss further the definition of written instrument and considered the possibility of deleting subsections 2 and 3 and pointed out that subsections 4, 5, and 6 employed the terms complete written instrument and incomplete written instrument, and in order to have a comprehensive code, each term about which there might be some question should be defined. It was felt that by me that it was advisable to employ a definition of complete written instrument and incomplete written instrument in order to make the meaning clear in these later definitions, or latter definitions rather, which pointed out the different ways in which forgery could be committed. and the rest of these, do you want to go through all these with respect to the forgery discussion?
No, we approved it, did you?
Yes, I know.
Well, I think in as much as we don't have to, we're not going to be going back over this. I don't think it's necessary, unless either of you guys do.
I don't think so.
We went down to through section 8, right?
Yes, which was fraudulently obtained the signature.
Okay. And all the sections we approved without substantial change.
That's right.
Okay. Well, then, If there's no objection, the minutes will be approved as read. And then we come to section 9, page 22, where we pick up today, right?
Yes.
Now, let me ask you, start off, Don, these four sections that we're going to cover today conclude our consideration of forgery and related offenses, is that right?
Yes, they do.
Now, does that also conclude our consideration of crimes against property? Is that it?
Well, I think it does, and I would like to point out that it's really a matter of classification, how we're going to group these offenses in the final code, whether we want to categorize some other areas that are going to have to be covered as crimes against property. I don't think they really are. Of course, for that matter, I think for the purposes of a topical organizational format for the code, that you could say, well, forgery really isn't a crime against property. But the Model Penal Code carries forgery and all of the fraudulent types of offenses under the broad heading of crimes or offenses against property. And but the New York organizational chart and their index does not classify forgery and fraud under crimes against property, nor does the Michigan format. So at this stage of our work, I think that we're at a point where I think that we can logically stop and say this completes crimes against property, because what is left? Our business and commercial offenses. Now, for example,
you mean what's left after section 12, or what's left here with regard to 9, 10, 11, 12?
Yeah, I mean, what's left after we finish our today's agenda? Really, our business crimes. And I think that we can logically place them separately in the organizational format. I think that as New York and Michigan has done, we can, for the purpose of classifying where these are going to fit into our code, we can put them separate from crimes against property. But I don't think it's a major consideration one way or another. It's for the purposes of orderly progression through these things, I think that we'll want to decide what we want to do. But frankly, I've just arbitrarily stopped with those and said to myself, well, this is the end of our work on crimes against property. But
let's go ahead, unless anybody has any questions or whatever, let's go ahead and get into this. It occurs to me that we're getting now into the area where we have to proceed with the greatest caution, because with regard to all the general larceny, burglary, OMFP, forgery statutes, our way is pretty clear cut. But every session of legislature, we have requests for special statutes to do away with parking meter thieves or telephone thieves or copper wire thieves or wherever. And if we're going to really achieve the right kind of objective here, we want to approach these commercial type crimes, draw our statute with respect to them in such a way as to discourage amendment after amendment after amendment in subsequent sessions of the legislature. And maybe we can't, maybe we just can't do it. But anyway, it's bothered me, so we'll probably want to bear this in mind as we go through here. So why don't you lead it off, Mr. Karen?
Okay, section 9 covers unlawfully using slugs. And I'm just going to get down to the commentary on this. Now, the purpose of the section is to prevent the use of slugs or other devices in coin-operated machines and professional manufacture of the slugs themselves. The culpability requirement that must accompany the use of a slug is an attempt to defraud the supplier. And that appears up under 1A of property or services. The intent that must accompany the manufacture or possession of a slug is an intent to enable a person to use it fraudulently. A coin machine, now that's under 1B. A coin machine is then defined under subsection 2A and hopefully is broad enough to include any type of vending machine or similar device designed to receive bills or tokens as well as coins. And I think it's important that we cover a machine that takes bills because you have these bill-changing machines and this type of thing, and more these are going to be on the scene where and they are quite a source of concern in some areas already. For example, I read a few weeks ago in a post office they had a coin changing machine where you could put money in, paper money, and it would give you change. And some children had found out that their paper money from a Monopoly or some darn thing would work in this thing, and they'd gone in there and they'd taken this machine for several hundred dollars before they found out they were using play money in it. So machines that do take things other than coins, I think should be covered. Then slug is defined and includes what we think of as the lead fake coin, any other device which is capable of being used in a coin machine as a fraudulent substitute for actual money. The subsection comes from Michigan Revised Criminal Code, section 4052, which was adapted from New York Revised Penal Law. Both of those states provide 2 degrees of punishment, and they make it more serious to possess or make slugs exceeding $100 in value. And they define value as the amount of money that these slugs would be equivalent to. And then I have limited it to a single degree. It didn't appear to me what I knew about this and what we were able to learn and read the statutes and checking for cases. I don't think that slugs are a big problem in this state. They should be covered. I think the kind of problem that we have are the use of slugs in the machines themselves rather than high-geared activity. But this is something that must be a policy question for the subcommittee, whether you want to get into a higher degree for possessing large numbers of these things.
Don't you think of a fancier name than slug to use in the statute?
Well, I suppose there are fancier names. This is something that has certainly a...
Under any other name, would this have to be a description?
It has a good secondary meaning that's come to attach to it, you know, and it's...
All you want to see is answers.
How about hickeys? See that with the pastimes used to give out?
And this week there, lessons.
Yeah.
I guess slug means false in anybody's language, don't it?
Well, it's defined. The meaning is defined.
Do we have parallel statutes?
Yes, we do.
Which one?
We have two statutes, 165, 525, and 530.
Oh, yeah.
525 covers the manufacture or sale of slugs, coin boxes. Now, the maximum penalty for a violation of that statute is 6 months and $500 for both. Then 165.530 covers possession of a device to procure a service or procuring a service without deposit. Coin. This covers possessing of the thing or using it in a coin machine, either one. And but the maximum penalty for that one, interestingly enough, is only a fine. $50 minimum and not more than $100. Let's see. And I, as I pointed out in my commentary, use of slugs in a telephone, for example. Obtaining the telephone service through use of slugs would be covered as a theft of service.
Well, that's the question that I have. And the other system probably thought of the same thing. But I wondered if possibly the theft of services statute that we've already agreed on wouldn't be broad enough to cover what we're getting at here. The person commits a crime of unlawfully using slugs if with intent to defraud a supplier of property or service sold or offered by means of a coin machine, he inserts deposits or otherwise uses a slug in such a machine. A person commits a theft if, with intent to avoid payment, therefore, he obtains services which are available only for compensation by force, threat, deception, or other means, or having control. As used in this section, services include but not limited to labor, professional services, transportation, control facilities, telephones, other communication services, the supply of food, lodging, other accommodations, etc. Now, if I put a slug in a telephone, I'd be committing theft of service.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, so aren't our two statutes run head on in each other?
Well, this is more specific, and of course they overlap in that respect.
I think there's some overlap, and I think these other states recognize that there was some overlap between these provisions. But this is the, with respect to coin machines, this is the kind of activity that is most likely to be used, although theft of services with respect to telephones, for example, would cover conduct such as a prearranged scheme to use a telephone without paying long distance tolls and this type of thing. So there would be other kinds of conduct with respect to coin machines or coin telephones particularly that would be covered by theft of services other than merely making a call on a coin telephone with a slug.
See, with the only test we have here in Sub 3 of theft of services is absconding without payment. And I think that there's some holes. I think there'd be some very big holes.
You mean if we...
Well, I think that the theft of services statute has some holes in it. Anyway, you know I voted against it.
Yes.
For that reason, because of paragraph 3. But I think that we'd be adding to the problem if we didn't drive something specifically the slug.
We didn't have any thoughts with respect to the class of the crime that theft of services would be. I mean, we thought it would be a misdemeanor.
Yeah.
And doubtlessly, unlawfully using slugs would be too. But we have a statute here for that makes it an inviolable misdemeanor for tampering with parking carries 2 years. Right? You weren't intending to embrace that within this.
No, that would be under criminal mischief type of activity.
That would be, yeah.
But now I should mention that the Michigan draftsman said, well, you could argue that this kind of conduct, that is, using a slug in a coin machine, could be covered as prosecuted as a theft of a service. But there's one thing that I think is a consideration, is that with the coin telephone, you don't usually, in fact, seldom, if ever, would you have a face-to-face confrontation between the defendant and the supplier of the service. And same way with any coin vending machine, in the machine sitting there, you don't have an individual who is being defrauded on a face-to-face confrontation. And
so by using the specific statute with respect to slugs, you could provide enforcement in a situation where, assuming that Bruce Balling didn't raise an entrapment defense, where the officer might have an empty phone box with nothing in there, stake it out, a guy goes in there, makes a call, and then they check and find that there are slugs in there. Is that true? From a problem of proof, this is a guarantee.
Well, yeah, for one thing, under this statute, you wouldn't have to prove that he actually obtained anything from the machine.
Well, that's right.
You see. Just the mere fact he used the slug in the machine would violate this statute. You wouldn't have to prove that he actually obtained any property out of the thing or service out of the machine, because it reads with intent to defraud. He inserts, deposits, or otherwise uses a slug in such a machine.
How do you prove there was intent to defraud? Just from the act?
Well, I suppose that would be the most likely ones you'd have, the fact that he did use a slug.
And you don't think tampering would cover it?
Well, no, I don't think putting a slug in it would be covered.
No.
If he used some other device on it, perhaps, if he had some one of these gadgets, you know, where they can insert it into the coin slot, and then after it triggers the slot, then pull it out. Now that might be come under tampering, possibly.
One other question. Maybe it comes under the credit card section, but there's a movement that started now. I think the First National Citibank or someplace in New York and elsewhere they have a credit card arrangement where you go in, you put a credit card into a coin machine or a machine device, and shoots out money at you. If you need some cash, you go in and put your credit card in the machine and get $50 or however much. You broaden this, Don, to say coin or bill. Would that situation, that credit card money situation, do you envision that under this, or would you envision it under the credit card? Credit card section that
we Well, I'll have to admit, I hadn't even considered that particular problem.
Probably come under subsection 2 or section 10.
Well,
what if it,
you mean if you're saying someone has a false card,
right,
a forged one or something?
A slug
counterfeit of some kind?
Right. So we have to put it in the machine. $50.
Well, if you could persuade the court that this was a token. This amounted to a slug because it was an object used as a fraudulent substitute for a genuine token. Frankly, I didn't have that in mind, particularly under the credit card situation, under Section 10.
Well,
why do you think about that?
I frankly don't have an answer.
What's the, why don't we think about it, give it some more thought. I don't know where it should properly fall. Is this basically then the Michigan statute?
Yeah, it's fundamentally the same.
Does sub B make possessive, particularly those two? Does that run head on into the counterfeiting language of the are we talking in forgery about counterfeiting?
Yeah, counterfeiting would be covered, but with counterfeiting, you're concerned with a bogus coin that is devised to look like the genuine. Whereas with the slug, it doesn't purport to be a genuine coin, as far as its appearance, anyway, it's not designed to be passed hand to hand as a forged instrument.
On page 5 of forgery, you have the existing statutes, and where in the draft, on what section of the draft was it that encompassed those statutes?
Page 15.
Well, now. See, our definition of written instrument includes any paper document, instrument, or article containing written or printed matter or the equivalent thereof, you see. Now, a coin, then it goes on used for the purpose of reciting, filing, conveying, or recording information, or constituting a symbol or evidence of value. That language was intended to include a coin, but it also, the coin would have something stamped on it, some printing or equivalent matter, whereas I don't think a slug normally would. At least the slugs I've ever seen were just lead, smooth, I mean, their dimensions and their weight and their shape is the same as a coin.
Yeah, but they might have plenty of Teflon.
Oh, they might, yeah.
And then you might have a Chinese penny.
Sure.
That would like red water.
Sure. But, well, first of all, I don't think that we can avoid having some overlap between these proposed sections. I think any more than we have had in our present law. I think that in a given set of facts, a crime's committed, then there may be out of those facts two or three separate statutory crimes that may have been committed. One statute might fit better than others. But I don't think that the mere fact that there might be possibility that the defendant could be charged with one of several separate statutes is unconstitutional or violates Berkey or anything like that.
Okay. Well, I'm just throwing these things up. I don't want anybody else to speak up.
What do you think?
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Well, let's look at sub A. A person commits the crime of unlawfully using slugs if, with intent to defraud the supplier of property or a service sold or offered. Now, let's stop there. I go in and put a slug in a Bell telephone payphone, and I'm arrested and charged, and charging part of the information has to recite the intent to defraud Pacific Northwest Bell, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if I go and put a quarter in a cigarette machine with intent to defraud the supplier or the owner of that machine, is that right? Give me, for instance, with respect to a service.
What are you talking
about?
Or a car wash, for example. I think it would be a service. And these are becoming...
Telephone would be a service.
Yeah.
Property would be like cigarettes.
Yeah.
Or candy.
Yeah, or an automat dispenses food. Chilled apples.
He inserts, deposits, or otherwise uses. Now, semantically, is there a need to have otherwise uses in there?
Well,
I would think so.
To cover what? Exigency.
A screwdriver. Wouldn't there's some article that would trigger the machine. You wouldn't have to really insert it or deposit it, maybe. Would that come within the definition?
No, because we're only talking about slugs.
Well, a device, by virtue of its size, shape, and other quality, is capable of being inserted or otherwise used.
Is there any constitutional objection to this because of vagueness? I noticed that Michigan says inserts, deposits, or uses. Frankly, I'm trying to split hairs here because it looks okay to me if you need to make a policy decision.
It was, frankly, use that language, which is different from Michigan or New York, but with the thought that it would be more definitive. Well, I felt that there might be a situation in which there might be a question whether you actually inserted the thing into the machine. And I don't think that there's a vagueness problem as long as a reading of the statute gives a reasonable reasonable meaning of what we're trying to prevent. And I think that you read the statute, and you know that you're not supposed to use the slug, either stick it in the machine or do anything else with it.
With intensity, probably.
Right. What we're prohibiting is the use of the fraudulent use of a slug on a machine. I think that it would be fatal from a vagueness standpoint. But,
okay.
Let's see.
What's a genuine coin? Genuine heart respect.
Now, what's that?
He wants to know the meaning of genuine there in the last line of the.
Genuine U.S. money or.
I suppose that's a substitute for the present Oregon language of lawful coin in the United States.
Well, yeah, genuine. My thought was that this meant that the true real item. That now, of course, a genuine token might not. Probably wouldn't be a something printed by the government.
It would be one that was sold for use in the machine.
Is that clear enough, Gabriel?
I think so.
Now, I think both Michigan and New York used genuine, although there wasn't any particular discussion about the use of that language. And, matter of fact, New York really doesn't have any commentary on these sections at all. Speak of the.
Are there any report of Oregon cases under the existing Oregon statutes?
No, there aren't. The only.
They're old state statutes.
Yeah, I. Of course, these, you know, you have misdemeanor convictions, and these are the kind of situations where the cases would probably never. I'm sure these statutes have been used, but.
How did that please?
Yeah, you know, they just never get to the Supreme Court.
It's like coin machines are poorly represented, I suppose.
I don't know. In Multnomah County, has this ever been much of a problem? Use of slugs on a large scale basis.
No.
Parking meters.
Yeah, parking meters. Yeah. And Ray Jenkins was kept busy on the phone company. But as far as prosecuting, I can't.
Yeah, a lot of trouble on the interstate bridge.
Used to. Well, as a matter of fact, I recall authorizing about 35 complaints one day to the state police on people that were defrauding the interstate trails.
Yeah, passed a law, was it 61 or 63 on that? It's a brand new statute.
I don't know whether that was for using slugs or what other theory we took, but that is correct. I think it was 61.
Was it?
Yeah. Well,
well, there just isn't any background commentary in either New York or Michigan on this, except Michigan did feel that there was a good reason to have a separate statute because there wasn't this face-to-face meeting between the defrauder and the defrauding. Mm-hmm.
Todd, why don't you, in addition to makes, possesses, or disposes of, include the sale? I'm looking at 525, which looks to me like a pretty good statute. And it says, any person who with intent to cheat or defraud the owner, lessee, licensee, or other person entitled to the contents of any coin collecting device referred to or described in this section, or who knowing or having cause to believe that it is intended for unlawful use, manufactures for sale, sells, or offers for sale any slug device or substance intended or calculated to be placed upon a deposit in any coin box, telephone, or other receptacle, depository, or contrivance designed to receive lawful coin of the United States in connection with the sale, use, or enjoyment of property or service shall be punished, etc. That's broader. Now that is a manufacturer sale, and then the next section is a possession or attempt to procure. But you don't provide in section 9 here for sale, do you? Unless it could be brought with
him. Disposes, yeah, that's what I had.
When you sell, you dispose.
If that is the intent.
Yeah, this sub B was intended to cover the manufacturer, and of course the manufacturer of these things would be usually one who's doing it for profit to sell them for some other person.
Well, wouldn't it be more explicit if we said makes, possesses, sells, or disposes of?
Slightest objection to sell.
Or makes, possesses, offers for sale, or disposes of. Because you might, persons.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a distinction without a difference, because if I'm offering it for sale and you arrest me, I'm in possession of it, so what's the difference?
You can offer someone else's goods for sale, can't you?
You mean and not...
And not possess?
And not technically be in possession of it?
I wonder. I don't know. You have it on consignment. Oh, I guess you'd be in possession then, technically, wouldn't you?
Guess you would.
Well, I think it would be possession.
But you could have a room full of coins somewhere and be selling them and on consignment and never be actually physically in possession.
Be a broker.
You'd be brokering, yes. That's
the constructive possession, eh?
And any other, the two other observations that I want to make, and I'm going to keep still and let me do what I want to do, is that it seems to me that the language that I, at the beginning of this Presnorden statute, where it talks about owner, lessee, licensee, or other person entitled to the contents thereof, is pretty good. Possibly it's unnecessary in view of your language here, supplier of property. I don't know. And the other thing is, where it uses the language lawful coin of the United States, or it's a little bit more than that. Maybe you have to do that.
lawful coin of the United States.
You're implying, aren't you, when you say coin or bill of a certain denomination, that it is money of the United States, aren't you?
Well, why don't you try to include the...
Here's a token.
Yeah, tokens that are manufactured.
Well, or a token made. No, that's...
Include all of those things. Because that was the intent.
A genuine token is a... Couldn't that make a genuine token?
Sure.
For my purpose, it's a genuine, but then for no one else, it is it's a genuine. But maybe I could have a genuine token.
Well, yeah, as opposed
same
to
as
a false
the,
token. As opposed to a false token.
Sure,
yeah.
Unless you're in good faith doing business with tokens.
Well,
in other words, if say a streetcar token issued by the streetcar company, or a bus token issued by a bus company, would be a genuine token.
It may be a genuine token for purposes of putting in the bus.
Yeah.
And you put it in that automatic copy machine.
Yeah.
It becomes a false
token. It becomes a false token.
Well, do we have to say anything about that? Or do we
well, we say a coin machine needs a coin box, turnstile of any machine or other mechanic or electronic device or receptacle designed to receive a coin or bill of a certain denomination. Or a token made for such purpose.
It's specifically for such purpose.
And then when we refer to genuine token, we're talking about a token that would have been made for a specific purpose and use.
Well, what's the way? I think that such purpose probably.
For such purpose, yeah.
Probably.
That probably slams the door shut.
What do you think, Bruce?
I
should have read the whole thing.
Well,
now I would point out that my definition of coin machine is taken from New York, but I broadened it a little because they. Say to assist in providing or for the insertion of deposit automatically to offer, to provide, to assist in providing or permit the acquisition of some property or service. Now, I say assist in providing or permit the acquisition or use of some property or service, which I think would cover temporary usage of something, temporary or the you're not actually acquiring something, but you're gaining a use of it through the use of these coins.
We're going to put offers for sale in sub B of 9, of 9-1.
I think it wouldn't be a bad idea.
I so moved.
You suggested we put it in after possesses?
After possesses.
Possesses, comma, offers for sale. Is there any discussion about that? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. Any other thoughts about this? I have a last couple of minutes. I have a terribly strange feeling. We're accepting everything. You think that after that series of meetings on arson that we've lost our punch?
We've become hurt, Don.
Or Don has anticipated our. Idiosyncrasies and has done a manipulative job on these drafts or on us.
No, Well, well, one likes to think that you learn from experience, you know.
Well, it looks okay to me. The only questions that I had were the ones that I raised, the one or two that I raised.
If you, in your judgment, think that genuine coin is okay, I'll go on with the two.
You think it's okay, Bruce?
Well, you ready for a motion?
Yes, I am.
I move we adopt section 9 as amended.
Okay. Second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. Right, can anyone ask for Don?
And section 10. Yeah.
Incidentally, Don, does the Model Penal Code have a slug? They have a statute for a Model Penal Code.
No.
Or do they bring it in?
Well, I would assume that they would cover it under
theft of services.
Yeah. And it's as far as possession, they have a general section on possession of instruments of crime and the possibility could fall under that, perhaps.
We don't, yeah, do we?
No, we don't have a general possession.
Does this fall under the within the scope of the subcommittee that's going to study general articles?
Well, I think it comes under inchoate crime.
By 1971, I'm going to know what inchoate crimes are. Okay.
Well, John, that's a...
That's elementary.
No, it's not elementary, but... No,
I know.
The trouble is that I forget every time.
I like that word because it's nebulous.
That's kind of a word that makes it worthwhile to have that Latin on your law degree. Lawyers understand it, people don't. Okay, section 10.
But maybe George Platt will be able to explain to us what inchoate crime means, because he's working on that.
Yeah, in the last year.
No, he has done some really good work on responsibility. We had a meeting 2 weeks ago on insanity defenses.
You're taking responsible position on it?
Yes, it's so.
The I guess it was the minutes that I read on it. Kind of like the committee would go that way.
His last meeting was mainly on procedural aspects of it, the requirement of giving notice and intent to rely on it. He has been working hard on that. Alright, now I should point out, now I don't know, I think this is just an oversight, flat out mistake on my part. Under 10A, I intended after stolen to have four forged in there. Purposes of this discussion. And in my commentary on page 28, last paragraph, it should say scope of the crime enlarged to include the use of a forged and stolen, or forged or stolen credit card. I intend to have both covered. I think personally they should be.
When the card is just found, where is that? It's just found and I started using it. Where is that? Is that covered under C?
Well, for any other reason, it's just the card's unauthorized.
Would that be true?
Sure.
If you find
a
card...
I do have the authority in the bank, and you only have been issued.
Yeah, you'd have to forge your name to even get the service, would you?
Well, no. Most credit cards, if you have possession of the card, you don't have to sign the name of the person whose name appears on the card. You could take that card and sign your own name, and they would be honored, I think. Because you see, the person who's selling you, that, say the gas station attendant, or the gasoline station owner, is not anything. He's going to get paid by the gasoline company.
But you have to sign on gasoline
credit. Yes, but you don't necessarily have to sign the name that's on the card.
In other words, I could give you my credit card, and you can go fill up your car and sign your name.
Right.
All right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I would get billed.
My son uses my credit card. Yeah.
I would get billed. You wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
just a.
Okay. Well, let's. If you want to, we'll just go through the commentary first, and go back to the substance of it. This is designed to cover instances that probably wouldn't amount to theft or theft of services. And then the commentary is section 224.6 of the Model Penal Code indicates the reasons for having a separate statute on credit cards. This is a new section to fill the gap in the law relating to false pretenses and fraudulent practices. Sections 223.3 and 223.7 cover theft of property or services by deception. It is doubtful whether they reach the credit card situation, because the user of a stolen or canceled credit card does not obtain goods by any deception practice upon or victimizing the seller. The seller will collect from the issuer of the credit card, because credit card users assume the risk of misuse of cards in order to encourage sellers to honor the card readily. Thus, it is the non-deceived issuer who is the victim of the practice. Now, this section comes from Model Penal Code 224.6. Michigan Revised Criminal Code, final draft 1967. The Michigan section is set out here in the tax material, section 4045. The stated intent is to injure or defraud, and is the same as that which is set forth in the forgery sections of the draft. The existing statute 165.300 requires an intent to defraud. The definition of credit card is an amended version of ORS 165.290. Sub 1 and is more precise than the Model Penal Code's writing or other evidence definition. I felt that the definition we had in the credit statute was pretty good and seemed more realistic and more accurate definition of the credit card. Three existing sections of ORS cover credit card crimes. 165.290 defines the term credit card and card holder. 165.295 deals with the unlawful taking, procuring, possession, alteration, or use of a credit card. ORS 165.300 prohibits the fraudulent use of a revoked or canceled card. The card itself would constitute property. Consequently, stealing a card, if you're talking about stealing the card itself, would be theft. Possession of a stolen card would probably amount to theft by receiving it. Forging a credit card or possession of a forged card is prohibited by the forgery sections of the draft, because a credit card would fall within our definition of written instrument.
Yeah.
Therefore, there is no purpose in having separate sections related specifically to theft or forgery of credit cards. What remains of the present statutes then in this draft is the gist of 165.300, which has been restated slightly, and with the scope of the crime broadened to include the use of a forged or a stolen.
Now, in 300, they talk about actual notice of eradication.
I didn't retain it.
You didn't retain it.
No.
You just stayed with knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose the actual notice that you have to prove, prosecution have to prove by means of a
signed, returned, received something that the defendant had received notice, whereas by use of the term knowledge, the fact that the prosecution could show a carbon copy of the letter that was sent and rely on the presumption, huh?
Yeah. Now, I left it out for ease of enforcement of these provisions.
I don't have any.
As a credit card user myself, I don't know. I suppose I'd rather have it in the law the way it is now. Make them have to prove that I received actual notice that my card had been canceled or revoked.
I represent a young guy that just is on the verge of bankruptcy. Several hundred dollars in bills, and he owed about five different oil companies, each one of which had written him and told him to send in his credit card.
And that it had been canceled.
Yeah, and he did. Assuming that, and these weren't registered or certified letters, they were just regular mail. Assuming that they had written to him, he hadn't received those letters, and went on using his credit card, they could come in and seek a criminal complaint against him for unlawful using a revoked or canceled credit card, and then it'd be questioned fact.
Yeah, he carried the burden of proof that he didn't cancel.
Right. I think personally, probably the credit card situation is
pretty. Well, we're really secretive today. This is a secret meeting. This is one of those days where if you have time to spare, you go by air.
It's a fly down or just drive down? From Hillsboro?
Well, I started from Bend, and when I got to Salem, I went below minimum, so I couldn't come here, so I had to go up to Hillsboro and let it lift for 45 minutes.
Yeah,
it's so. Yeah, it's kind of sticky down to about 1,000 feet right now, so.
Talking about credit cards, Bob, on page 27 of the Big Book, or that is 27 of the forgery draft. And I was just going to say that I feel personally that probably the situation with respect to credit cards is so unique and sufficiently serious that maybe the necessity for proper enforcement outweighs the requirement for actual notice. Is that what you thought about?
Yeah. But at the same time, I don't think that part of the statute, the part relating to using a revoked or canceled card, is really what we're really concerned with in these cases. Most of those cases. Right, because most of those cases would be handled on a civil basis. I mean, it's going to be a rare instance, I would think, where a credit card company is going to come to the district attorney in the county where one of its cardholders has run up a large bill after his credit card has been revoked and want to prosecute him in the criminal courts.
I'll tell you one situation where the district attorneys are plagued and attorneys generally play is in domestic relations situations. Happens to me every week or so.
Who wants a credit card?
She ran away and she got my credit cards and she's not authorized to use them and
authorized by him to use them?
Mm-hmm. Well, can he take some steps? Shut that off, though. If he really wants to do it, he wants to have his credit card changed, yeah. Numbers changed. It's like changing locks on your door. It's a lot of trouble sometimes.
Yeah, of course, it's a long, cumbersome process, particularly with a gasoline credit card, because they're so mobile, and no pun intended, but they are. It's a mobile type thing where they're, you know, every place has a gas station, and of course, the gas companies send out these periodic hot sheets of stolen and canceled cards and things like that. But have you ever seen any?
600 to the page on them,
sure.
Nobody ever has a chance to check them.
When you see some poor guy running a gas station, they sit down, and even if he did read it, he'd never remember it at all. And if every customer had to stop to have his credit card checked, see if he's on the hot sheet, he'd soon be out of business. But so it's a long process. But
well, it kind of seems to me like, well, if you're going to prosecute somebody for a criminal charge, you don't have personal service or at least certified mail service or something. Well, but you're...
Then it has been canceled.
Yeah. It's one thing to cancel it and rely on your civil remedies, but it's another to prosecute somebody.
Oil companies send these cards out wholesale, whether you want them or not.
Yeah.
You get three or four. I got a whole drawer full up there.
In fact, we had a bill in the last session of the legislature to prohibit them, and you never saw such activity in the lobby.
Well, you take it, you go across the country in an airplane, you land someplace, and they tell you, well, we'll take any credit card. They give them a standard credit card. The next week, you get back one from some other oil company you never heard of, because that oil company doesn't, you know, that dealer just sells American or somebody else. By the time you make a trip from here to Chicago, you come back in the next 2 weeks where you get a new credit card a day.
And they keep sending them to them. They're on their list.
In the 6 years, they write you a plaintive letter while you haven't bought anything.
that's okay on civil stuff, but I've got some reservations about it. I don't know. Maybe it's already in the law, I guess. That's right. That you can... Or are we changing that?
Well, for this, you still have to prove that he had knowledge that the card was canceled.
Yeah.
And wouldn't an uncertified letter where the proof was that it was mailed and that he is addressed and he lived there be prima facie proof of no?
It'd be prima facie proof of knowledge, and it could be rebutted by his testimony. I analogized the situation that I had so many times with a notice of suspension from the motor vehicle department on suspended operator license cases. And initially, all the motor vehicle department was doing was just sending out letters. And prosecute somebody, they say, well, I didn't receive a notice. The judge would find the defendant. So then what we started doing in Portland was requiring a return receipt requested, and we get a certified copy of the defendant's signature when he received the letter. And we introduced that together with a certified copy of suspension. And that would work. But I guess actually, but yes, the proof that the letter had been sent would be prima facie.
Well, that'd be prima facie proof of actual notice.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. But that wouldn't be rebutted by the guy saying he didn't receive it.
Sure.
If he goes to the certified route and got a signature, they've got a different case.
I don't know how these.
So, well, the point of that is I don't see a great deal of difference between actual knowledge and knowledge. Reading with attention. That's what we're talking about.
Right.
If you want to use the word act.
Right. I guess it wasn't a great deal.
I don't know whether these gasoline companies, when they cancel or revoke a card, what method they use. Do you know, John? Do they send a registered mail letter?
No, at least in this case, I had this last month.
I think they send out.
It was just a letter, a demand letter for the deficiency, demand letter for payment and that, requesting the credit card be turned in.
I'm glad you got that now in your personal, in your professional capacity, personal capacity.
Right.
Wondering how he was going to get an answer from this crowd. Is that
I don't know whether they can prosecute legislators for unlawfully using their legislative their telephone credit card. Maybe we ought to write something in an immunity section.
I should just put that in as bill number two of the Senate this time to see how far it gets.
There's a particularly good commentary, I think, on this. Bob, that we put Don went over just before you came in, C on the next page, he does it out. And I've got another question concerning the definition of credit card, but I don't think. I want to know what anybody else thinks.
Well, if you've read these definitions of credit cards, if they have them in the model penal code in Michigan, right? Well, I tell you, for one thing, what I thought was wrong with the Michigan definition of credit card, they have employed pretty much the model penal code definition of credit card. But which is a writing. Now, writing, however, is defined in the Model Penal Code for purposes of forgery and fraudulent practices as meaning certain things, which includes, which includes all these things that we considered as being subjects of forgery. And of course, we use the definition of and the term written instrument. Interestingly enough, Michigan also uses the term written instrument, but and then it's defined very similarly to what our definition is. However, then when they get to credit card, which is part of their related offenses in their forgery articles, they go back to saying credit card means a writing, but nowhere do they define writing, you see. In other words, the Model Penal Code, writing is defined.
Right.
But under Michigan, they don't define writing, they define written instrument.
Right.
So, whether that was intentional or not, I don't know. But I felt that that there wasn't really any purpose to be served in getting off into written instrument or anything else for purposes of the credit card. That we should have a separate definition.
Well, you say here, I guess what your definition is, credit card means a card booklet or other identifying symbol or instrument under evidencing or undertaking evidencing and undertaking to pay for property or services rendered to or upon the order of the designated person or bearer. That seems inclusive. Credit card under our present law says means any instrument, whether in the form of a card booklet, plastic, or metal substance.
So actually what I did in my definition, I combined some of the language out of that in our present statute with the definition that appears in the Model Penal Code.
I don't commentary to say the scope of the kind of ours that include use of a forged credit card. I don't read that.
Yeah.
No.
Right. Now, before you got here, I mentioned that there was an error here. It's my mistake. Under sub A, that was meant to read the card is stolen or forged. And then my commentary on page 28, the last line should say forged or stolen credit card.
Get pretty hard to forge this thing.
any undertaking to pay. Doesn't say anything about it.
Have you read the stuff that you tear it out of? No, it comes in the middle of a big sheet, and you tear a little piece out and put it in your pocket.
I'm wondering about the evidence in the undertaking that you pay. How was it supposed to evidence that?
Well, this shows to the person, or the in the case of telephone credit card, that your number would indicate to the telephone company, the operator, that
you have that there
is an undertaking on your part to pay for calls made on that.
Yeah, number. The card itself is not a written agreement, but is an undertaking.
Well, it's evidence of an undertaking.
Yeah.
This shows that there is an agreement between you and the supplier of that card that you will pay for.
Well, now, wait a minute. Where you get an unsolicited card that might not contain any more material than is contained on this, it would be a unilateral agreement. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't evidence that?
Well, of course, I think it does, because in the case of the telephone credit card, all it's done is charge against your regular telephone bill. The telephone credit card is your telephone number with a couple other gadgets on it. And you agreed to pay all the bills charged to that telephone when you originally got the telephone. I don't think that you'd, because you don't have to use the telephone. You go in here and call off the phone, say you want to charge it to your phone number in Bend, and charge it while they check through Bend. All this does is save them checking through Bend to make sure you're the same guy. It's supposed to be. But haven't you agreed when you originally signed up for the telephone and signed the installation order to pay for all calls transferred?
I think so.
All legitimate calls, but everybody has a situation where they get their bill and they have one or two calls on there.
They don't know about it.
They don't know about it, and they make a complaint to the phone company, and it's adjusted.
Yeah, and then the phone company goes back and charges it to whoever the call was made to.
If they can find it.
Oh, they can. If they can find it. It isn't made to a payphone.
Well, I don't think that I like the shorter definition that you have here, Don, providing that we all feel that it's sufficiently inclusive to me.
If you didn't, if it wasn't inclusive enough, say, for the phone company, the oil company cards and the American Express and the Bank of America card and so forth, they're pretty careful to say that by the use of it, you agree to pay for any charges made against it. So they're rare that. And that'd be theft of a service if you stole from the phone company if you didn't want to go back to if they didn't want to go back to the credit card, then they would go back to theft of service.
Right, we were talking about that a little bit earlier.
Well, that language is model penal code language. This evidence of an undertaking.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And they have no commentary on that particular aspect of their draft.
Did they just say credit card means a writing purporting to evidence an undertaking to pay for property or services delivered or rendered to or upon order upon the order of a designated person or bearer?
Use of this card is governed by the conditions set forth when issued.
Boy, in those days were prohibited by law.
Didn't even say that.
Well, I want to take a break after we. I thought we'd finish this section. What do you think?
I should mention one other thing, I think, about this. Now, under our present statute, you'll notice that it provides, it's really an indictable, well, it's not indictable misdemeanor, but it provides for petty or grand larceny type of punishment. But you'll notice that it's punishable by 5 years maximum if the total amount of the goods or services so obtained exceeds $75. So you can tack on, it's a accumulated thing. In other words, if one individual goes to three different places and uses this card, you can use all three places to get over $75 for prosecuting for a felony. Now, of course, this draft doesn't have any penalty provisions in it yet, and this is something that we would want to keep in mind when we do get to the point of grading these offenses, that probably, I would think, want to retain that distinction and provide for a stiffer penalty if you get up into the grand larceny type of category. Because I know that we had cases in Lane County where you'd be hard-pressed to get a felony charge on somebody for one of these if you were limited to just each place. Unless you go in and buy a set of tires or something like that, you're not too often going to get over $75. But so often they'll go on a credit card spree when they get one of these things, and you know,
a couple thousand is pretty quick.
But so you can use all of these.
Well, here again, we get back to the situation of grading these, my own thought is that it'd be inadvisable for another subcommittee that hasn't been through the pros and cons of these various statutes that we've gone over to come in and arbitrarily start setting penalties. I think this subcommittee, perhaps with some general guidance from the commission after policy, how we're going to grade crimes, would be in the best position to say.
Well, after general policy's reached, we may want to change some gradations.
I'm just fearful of that.
I suspect that if we come up with a $100 limit on such and such a type of offense, we go back through this thing.
Yeah, although I don't think we're going to run into too much. I don't think we're going to run into too much difficulty as far as having to revise our substantive provisions. I think the policy considerations that would affect that part of what we've done have been made already, except for penalties. I don't see where there's going to be anything that come up that would affect our work so far.
Why don't we take a break and we'll
talk. Okay.